Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Volatility's back. Emerging markets are a mess. Ben Bernanke is gone. What are we going to do? Well, we'll tell you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the last day of January, everybody. It's a Friday. Good as always to have you with us. You know, there are Fridays on which one wonders where to start this particular radio program, what the big economic story of the week might have been. Oh, not so today. It comes to us indirectly via Wall Street and is neatly but somewhat ambiguously wrapped up by the term emerging markets. Here to help us wrap up the week are Catherine Rampell from The New York Times and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Good afternoon.
Felix, I need you to help me feel better. First of all, is this emerging markets meltdown? Is that too strong a word?
No, it's not. They're imploding.
That's not making me feel better,
the world. It's Argentina, it's Turkey, it's you name it. It's every country where people were running to put their money and get high returns in a low return world. Suddenly all of that money seems to have evaporated.
Catherine, help me understand, though. That money is leaving the emerging markets, and it is, in theory, coming here because we're the safe place. And if that's true, why is the stock market going down?
I think there's still a lot of concern about this volatility, about returns being quite low here. If a lot of money floods into the United States, where yeah. interest rates are still incredibly low, near zero, in fact. So there's a lot of concern about the uncertainty that lies ahead.
Is there a way, Catherine, that this comes back and bites the American economy in the keister?
To the extent that instability anywhere can be contagious and can get investors a little bit skittish, more than a little bit skittish, consumers a little bit skittish. Yes, I mean, confidence feeds on confidence. And if you have a lack of confidence elsewhere and so many markets are interlinked, then that's problematic.
Felix, I'm going to take the other side. All right, well, give me another chance to make me feel better, right? I mean, come on here.
Yeah.
All right,
This is a continent-sized economy we have going on here in the United States. We just had a very solid GDP growth number. Most Americans just deal with other Americans. Most American companies just deal with other American companies. We're not a tiny island nation like the one I come from, which means that if something weird is going on in Argentina or in Turkey— Honestly, it doesn't make that much of a difference to the United States.
Yeah,
the United States
but
can
multi-
weather this.
You go,
okay.
Catherine. You go. Come on.
I don't know. Multinational companies are
right.
an increasingly
exactly.
important part of our economy.
What she said.
They have a lot of exposure abroad. You know, we are much more interlinked today than we were in the past.
And Felix,
so
here's
I think
the
it's
other,
still worrisome.
Right. And Felix, here's
no,
the other thing.
No,
hold it. New topic. That GDP report, okay. since you brought it up, right? 3.2%
yes.
nifty, but not what it was a quarter prior, and a little sign of softness on corporate spending. Is it as good as you thought it was, really?
I'll take it. I'm happy with it, honestly. I'm not going to complain at 3.2%. That's a good, solid figure. I'm not going to start looking that gift horse in the mouth.
Let me explain my fear, then. I just worry that it's yet another spring, which would be, I think, four to the last five, in which it's two steps forward, one step back in the economy.
So what's the step back?
Well, it's not as high as, you know, the growth rate was slower than the prior quarter.
Oh, this is Kai Rizdahl with his second derivatives. We're going
yes,
up.
Yes, yes. How
going
long have you known me?
At a slower,
okay,
at a slower pace.
Let me do the regression and I'll run my spreadsheet, and I'll get back to you.
I'm going to be optimistic on the first derivative, and you can be pessimistic on the second derivative, and I'm the person going to be going up, and you're going to be going up as well, just not realizing it.
Oh, my. I don't if I even knew what any of that meant. All right. We have a minute left. We have 45 seconds left. New topic. I saw, honestly, what was kind of a sad picture. Ben Bernanke walking out of the Federal Reserve building for the last time today. Catherine, how will he be remembered in the fullness of history?
I think he will probably be remembered very positively as rescuing the economy, at least from going off the brink, particularly at a time when Congress was not doing a whole lot to help the United States economy keep from going over the edge. He took a lot of non-traditional measures, a lot of really scary measures, and was a very creative thinker and, you know, as an academic, was probably uniquely prepared to deal with the crisis given his past research into the Great Depression and other equally frightening episodes.
Felix, your quick thoughts on Mr. Bernanke as he goes?
Yeah, what Catherine said. He stepped up. He did what he had to do. He didn't win any popularity contests, but given the utter inaction by Congress, he was the person who helped the economy get growing again.
All right, I got to go look up second derivatives. Felix Salmon from Reuters, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Have yourselves a good weekend, guys.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you later. Here is what we can say about Wall Street today. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Amazon announced fourth quarter profits yesterday, profits being a relative term here. Lots and lots of new revenue at the world's biggest online retailer, cash coming in the door. Actual net earnings, not so good, a relatively paltry $239 million. One response that Jeff Bezos and his colleagues are said to be considering is to jack up the price for Amazon Prime, the service that for $79 a year gets subscribers perks like free shipping and streaming movies. Turns out that Prime is one of Amazon's biggest profit makers and a cornerstone of its strategy for years to come. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
I have loads of fish, primarily angelfish, gouramis, betas.
Brad McCarty is with software company Full Contact. He's a tropical fish man and an Amazon Prime member.
I have a few sites that I go to and I do research, but then I usually end up going back to Amazon to buy them because I am a Prime member, and I'm going to get free shipping on that.
Amazon uses data it has on McCarty's past fishy purchases to get him to buy more. McCarty says he is the business model for Amazon Prime.
Well, Amazon is, for the most part, kind of like a perpetual Black Friday sale, right? You bring people in the door with the hopes that they're going to buy more stuff when they get there.
There are more than 20 million Prime members, and the $79 they pay pretty much covers the cost of the free shipping they get. The rest is gravy, and there's a lot of gravy. Amazon Prime customers spend twice what regular customers do.
Where you start just buying everything through Amazon.
Scott Galloway is a professor of marketing at NYU. He says Amazon has purposefully sacrificed short-term profits to get more customers and more pricing muscle.
At a certain point, we'll be able to flex their muscles and become a very profitable company.
Galloway says Amazon considering a price hike for Prime could be a sign its investors are getting restless.
Amazon is acknowledging that the cocktail of huge growth and low profitability may be becoming a bitter cocktail for investors.
But the rationale for raising prices may not be fast cash.
At Amazon, nothing is ever what it seems.
Mike Levin is with Consumer Intelligence Research Partners in Chicago.
The customers probably will spend more. So quite ironically, by kind of raising the price of this membership, they may end up getting people to shop there even more.
A more expensive Prime membership equals a customer who's all the more motivated to get their free shipping's worth. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
A long-awaited environmental report on the Keystone XL pipeline was out today. It basically says, build the pipeline, don't build the pipeline. The Canadian tar sands are going to be developed either way. President Obama, of course, gets to be the decider on that one, but a whole bunch of business groups aren't waiting to engage the White House on the really big question in all of this, the role of all fossil fuels down the road. This week, they announced something called a Partnership for a Better Energy Future. The Chamber of Commerce and dozens of industry lobbying groups are behind it. They say they want to, and this is a quote, work with the EPA as the agency looks beyond coal in its efforts to limit greenhouse gas emissions. A whole lot here, depending on the definition of work with. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more.
The 70-plus members of the Partnership for a Better Energy Future all have one thing in common.
All of these members utilize energy.
That's Karen Harbert from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The EPA is moving forward with regulations on coal-fired power plants. Harbert says the partnership's members see more energy regulations coming down the line.
We recognize that and we support that. But what we aren't seeing on the other side of EPA is a fair, balanced, and open process.
From Harbert's perspective, the EPA's coal regulations have been rushed. She thinks they'll hurt the energy industry more than necessary. She says her members worry that broader regulations could hurt the overall economy, which explains why the Myrtle Beach Chamber of Commerce is on the member list. Here's Brad Dean, the group's president.
If our economy is succeeding, people have more money and more wherewithal to travel. So we've found that, you know, what's good for the American economy is good for tourism.
The National Fertilizer Institute sees a big threat. Here's the group's president, Christopher John.
This is a bet-the-farm situation for the industry.
That means pooling resources to lobby both regulators and Congress, and public advocacy. The National Association of Manufacturers says the budget is in the millions and TV ads are a possibility. The partnership's members say they want to take part in a serious conversation. Pete Altman isn't buying it. He's from the Natural Resources Defense Council.
The only time when we hear from this crowd, oh, we really need to talk this through, is when they're actually afraid that something might happen.
He thinks the real tactic is to delay.
The strategy of sort of like, no, let's drag this out and maybe we'll have a better president.
If final regulations aren't in place before President Obama's term ends, a new president could reverse course. That's an assertion that Karen Herbert from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce denies.
We're not saying run out the clock. We're saying take the time that is necessary to do the analysis.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The currency trade is part of what's behind the slipperiness in emerging markets the past couple of weeks. See also the Turkish lira and the Argentine peso, as Felix was saying not too long ago. Foreign exchange actually can be a pretty volatile place, which, of course, leaves some room for, shall we say, questionable trades. So U.S. and European regulators are investigating whether banks have been manipulating the global currency market through a little-known number called the 4 p.m. fix. Christopher Worth reports from London.
Every day, traders buy and sell over $5 trillion worth of euros and Japanese yen and U.S. dollars. And unlike the stock market's closing bell at the end of the day, the trade in currency practically never stops.
The foreign exchange market is the only market that operates 24 hours.
Joe Marston is a small-time retail foreign exchange trader. He says the foreign exchange market draws a line in the day's trading every day at 4 p.m. London time. Marston says whatever exchange rates happen to be within a 60-second window become what's known as the 4 p.m. fix.
The 4 p.m. fix was devised so everybody around the world knows what the price is at 4 o'clock. So that's the benchmark.
And it's an important benchmark. Multinational companies and pension funds use it as a price to make enormous foreign currency deals. And regulators suspect traders may have rigged the 4 p.m. fix to make more profit. And here's how. The day I visited Marston, the euro just hovered at about $1.35 in U.S. dollars.
It hasn't really moved. It's such a quiet market today.
But just moments before the 4 p.m. fix is set, the numbers on Marston's screen start to tick.
It's moving up a little bit. Sometimes the market can actually move quite violently a few minutes before.
And that's what's attracted the attention of U.S. and European regulators. Mark Taylor is a former currency trader, now dean at Warwick Business School. He says if you look at the 4 p.m. fix over several months, you start to see a very suspicious pattern.
Round about exactly 4 p.m., there appear to be jumps in the exchange rate that disappear after a few minutes. What it suggests is that people are deliberately trying to manipulate the market around that time.
Traders at some of the world's largest banks are suspected of collaborating through online chat rooms with names like the Cartel and the Bandits Club. And the traders are believed to have conspired to combine billions of dollars in trades to shift the 4 p.m. fix. It's what's known in trader speak as banging the close.
It suggests that you're banging something in order to move it, and you've only got to move the market a small amount for a small period of time for that to translate into literally millions of dollars of profit.
Taylor says the concern is that banks make that profit by charging clients the higher 4 p.m. fix rate while really putting currency trades through at a lower price once the market settles down. Richard Payne at Cass Business School says for the moment these are just allegations. But this is possible, he says, because the global currency market is largely unregulated and concentrated among just a handful of players.
There are only a few big banks that control the vast majority of currency trading on the planet. And we can all name them. Deutsche Bank, Barclays, UBS.
Along with Citigroup and JP Morgan. None would comment for this story, but many banks have already suspended their top currency traders as investigations continue. And any proof of wrongdoing could bring steep fines. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I got Peyton chasing me. I got Teddy Bruschi chasing me. He's the linebacker for New England. And they're both giving contrary stories to what happened.
Don't watch the game, you guys. Watch the refs. The next installment of You Hate My Job straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here we go. The Dow Industrials off 149 points today, 0.9%. Closed at 15,698. The S&P 500 also in the red, down 11 points, 2/3%, closed at 1782. The NASDAQ, my gosh, yes, it slipped as well, albeit a little bit less, down 19 points, nearly 0.5%, finished at 4103. Let's hope for a better February at the corner of Wall Street and Broad, huh? This month saw a 5% drop on the Dow, nearly 2% down for the NASDAQ, 3% drop for the S&P 500. In today's trading, Mattel didn't look so hot. Its stock wheeled down 12% today after the toy maker said sales of action figures and Barbie dolls were weak over the holidays. Zynga, the mobile game maker, zipped up 23% today after announced it was laying off 15% of its staff and buying a rival game maker, Natural Motion. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for December. We celebrate the 101st anniversary of the ratification of the 16th Amendment, the one that created income tax. Sounds like a sheet cake occasion. And speaking of celebrations, it's Dump Your Significant Jerk Week. Ah, happy times. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Census Bureau came out today with some updated information on home ownership in this country. Down is the quick and dirty summary. The percentage of Americans who own their own homes has fallen to its lowest level in almost two decades, 65.2%. Back in 2004, for context, it was just a tick above 69%. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman headed out from his bureau in Portland, Oregon, to see what that decline might look like.
There's a lot of construction going on right now, or at least a lot more construction than there was a few years ago. And a lot of it is rental apartments, not single-family homes to buy. So why is home ownership down almost 5% since before the recession? I asked economist Patrick Newport at IHS Global Insight.
It's much more difficult to qualify for credit. And in addition to that, you've had a number of people who have lost their homes to foreclosure. Those people are now becoming renters.
Who's being shut out of home ownership? First off, anyone with low or unreliable income. Also, young people. They've delayed getting hitched, buying a first home, because jobs are scarce. Problem is, many working-class families with steady but moderate income are out of luck too, says Nicholas Ritsinas at the Harvard Business School.
They're the ones who are not able to have anything left from their paycheck so they can accumulate savings to make that down payment overall. They're the ones who have difficult times paying back a mortgage, even with these very low interest rates.
Ritsinas says for many, owning a home turned out to be a risky, unprofitable proposition in the late 2000s.
But 50 years prior to that, it was a primary source of wealth creation.
And if home values rise steadily again, but middle-class families can't buy into that, they'll lose a key tool for building wealth and security in the future. Christopher Mayer studies housing at Columbia Business School. He sees an aging homeowner population.
If you look at people today who are 65 years old, 86% of them are homeowners. If what we've done is push back the age at which people become homeowners, I don't find that terribly alarming. If we're really going to move to a renter society, we're going to have a lot of problems.
Starting with, where will today's young people live and what will they live on, if not home equity, when they're old and gray?
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As you settle back on the couch with your chips and dips and beverages of choice Sunday to watch the Super Bowl, do me a favor. For at least a couple of plays, don't watch the game. Unfocus your eyes a little bit and watch the refs, because the players aren't the only ones who've earned their way to the championship, and they're not the only ones feeling the pressure. On today's installment of You Hate My Job, one particular type of occupation that might get the most hate this weekend, the professional referee. Bill Carollo is a retired NFL ref. He is currently the director of officiating for the Big Ten Conference. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kai.
First of all, how does one become a referee of national stature? You obviously don't just walk in the door and say, hi, I'd like to put on the striped shirt.
Well, it's a long process to become a referee, but to become a referee of high stature and national attention, it's usually because we made a big mistake. That's how we become famous. It looks pretty simple on TV and slow motion and on replays, but the reality is if you want to get to the NFL, it might take you 22 to 24 years on the average.
What's it like then the first time you step on the big stage, whether it's a national championship game for college or you know the playoffs or the Super Bowl, which you've been in twice at the NFL?
Right. Well, I think that if you say that you're not nervous, you're probably kidding yourself and you probably aren't really prepared. Whether it's the Rose Bowl when I worked, 26 years ago or a Super Bowl, you think you're ready and you think you know yourself pretty well. But when you get on the big stage and Vanessa Williams singing the national anthem at the Super Bowl and jets are flying over, I thought I was really ready and then I couldn't even swallow.
Talk me through it. What's it like when you're in the middle of not necessarily a blown call, not a mistaken call, but a controversial call, right? And you have 75,000 people screaming at you, Jim Harbaugh is screaming at you, Peyton, whoever is yelling and screaming at you, and you have to figure out what the rule is, what the right thing to do is. Take me through that process.
Well, a few years back, I was working a championship game, and it didn't involve Peyton Manning. It did involve, right before the half, a controversial pass interference call in the end zone. It was New England against Indianapolis in the AFC championship game in Indy. And Peyton throws a pass, and of course, my job as the head referee, I'm watching the quarterback. But I can sense from the crowd that there's some action going on in the end zone. I got Peyton chasing me. I got Teddy Bruschi chasing me. He's the linebacker from New England. And they're both giving contrary stories to what happened. And I get to my referees. I clear everybody out. One referee thought for sure it's pass interference. The other referee thought for sure it wasn't. Mm. And, of course, I didn't see the play. Now I have to make a decision.
Yeah, what do you do?
I said, pick up the flag. We're not guessing. I don't want a phantom call. Peyton Manning is really upset. and so is the crowd now. Now I can feel the pressure. It isn't so much the crowd. It's just like I'm on national TV and this better be right. After halftime, Peyton comes out. He comes right to me and I go, oh, no. He puts his hand out. I said, I can't shake your hand. And he says, I'm just telling you, I want to apologize. You were right. Reggie Wayne tripped on his own. He went down.
He had watched it in the locker room at halftime, right?
Yeah. And Reggie Wayne said, no, I really didn't. No, I wasn't interfered with. I tripped over my own feet. Huh. But sometimes you're not so lucky. I'm working another championship game in St. Louis with Tampa Bay. We gave them a catch down the field. Replay buzzes me, and they said, take a look at it. And, of course, I come out and not only look at it, I reverse it to an incomplete pass, take Tampa out of it. I probably received 200 calls to my house. I'm unlisted. I had about 15 or 16 people got arrested for death threats. I had to pull my kids out of school. And that's when we make the right call, Kai.
Wow. When you blow one, does it stay with you?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And there's a lot of pressure, and you think you'll be able to make those calls because you've done them before in the past. You've done them at the lower levels. But when the pressure's on, we're all human, Kai, and we are going to make mistakes. And in college, we make about 5 or 6 mistakes a game collectively as a crew. Yeah. NFL guys are a little bit better, and they make about 3 mistakes, 3.5 mistakes per game. And we get measured and graded on every single play. So contrary to what many of our fans think, where are these guys come from? They can't see. They're old and they're out of shape. And, well, sure, I can't run a 4.3. I never could run a 4.3 40.
So here's your chance to talk to, 6 million people who are listening to this radio program. If you had a moment to talk to the fans about the refs, what would you tell fans?
Well, I think there's probably a misconception on who these guys are
and they really don't care, and they favor a team, et cetera. It's easy to sit back and on your television HD in the basement, man cave, and come up with, he wasn't in bounds, it's not a catch. Well, we get that, but when you look at all the toughest plays that go to replay, nearly 70% are upheld.
Huh.
These guys get the tough ones right most of the time on the field.
Bill, thanks very much for your time.
Excellent. Thanks, Kai.
Bill Carollo there, a 20-year veteran of the NFL, now director of officiating for the Big Ten. If you think you can cut it, by the way, we've got a link to some of Bill's officials' quizzes and tests. They are at marketplace.org. And take a second to tell us about the jobs that you love to hate. You can tweet them to us at Marketplace. APM is the show. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. We will pick the best and put them on the radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which comes to us courtesy of the letters S, E, and O, search engine optimization. So here you go. What time is the Super Bowl? Seems like a simple question, right? 6:30 Eastern, by the way, is the answer. But it turns out most people don't know how to spell Super Bowl. Here's a helpful hint. It's actually two words, both capitalized. A couple of years back, the Huffington Post published a story titled, What Time Does the Super Bowl Start? Spelling it the way most people did, one word lowercase. Just to game the web traffic, they did it. And of course, it blew up. Lots of hits for HuffPo back then. And even today, the rest of the internet keeps on trying to get a piece of that traffic. This year's version, the search words of choice about the game, Superb Owls. Think about it for a second. Superb Owls. And if you can't figure it out, might take a minute. It did me, I will confess. You should just go ahead and Google it. I can't even talk today. All right, here we go. That's Market. I don't know second derivatives either. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 149 points. The NASDAQ slipped as well, just a little bit, 19 points. S&P 500 also in the red, down 11 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. Superb Owls. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.